RCR with Paul Brennan.
Last time we spoke to Tony Gosling, independent journalist from the UK, background as a BBC reporter, now investigative journalist, was November, early November. Quite a bit has happened since then. It's a new year. And just in the last, month, really, it's all been going on. And we thought we'd get Tony back with us, joining us from the UK. Late at night there, Tony. So thank you for giving up your time. Nice to have you back.
Thank you. No problem. It's always, I think New Zealand to me is one of those places where there's still a little bit of the remnants of, you know, I can remember my first arrival probably must be 10 years ago over there and seeing phone books in the phone boxes, which is just like something from the 1960s or 70s they probably have now. Yeah. But, you know, anyway, the evil empire hasn't quite sort of taken over New Zealand.
Well, I don't know about that. No? That's maybe for another chat, but certainly the tentacles feel like they around. So last time we talked was November, and here we are on a month after President Trump becomes the 47th president. He's back in office. Where do you want to start? Because so much is just sort of shaken out of that in such a short time.
Trump himself is an interesting character. I think it's important to understand politicians, having met quite a few. Most of them nowadays really do seem to be these kind of robotic types that say what they think they're supposed to say. I've got absolutely no aptitude for the job, which is why they're in the job. And that is not the case with Trump. I mean, his attitude to Gaza, I think, recently, saying we're going to build the Riviera here. I mean, it shows so much about who this person is. You know, a property developer from New York. New York is, you know, a pretty rough, tough city. And he's one of the roughest and the toughest that survived it. But he's only survived it as a terrific old article, if anyone's really interested in this stuff, can't remember the name of it. Anyway, it's called A Mafia Don with a Pompadour. And it's written by a writer. He's a Russian-speaking German-born, I think. William Engdahl, that's him. I don't know. He may not be with us anymore because I know he was very elderly when he was writing in Trump's first term. And he explains a lot about Trump's personality. So he's one of these real go-getters from New York, but he's always had to kowtow to the mafia. So he's fallen several times financially and had to go basically down on his bended knee. And it was Sheldon Adelson in Las Vegas that became his big patron. He died recently, but his wife is still extremely wealthy and been donating to Trump. So really, he's a creature of the mafia, even though he likes to think he's managed to con himself into thinking that he's a sort of free spirit, independent. He's not really. And this the big problem with this administration is its ties to Silicon Valley and big tech. It seems to me that he's decided that these are, I don't know if you've seen, there's a fantastic Johnny English film, which was made by George Harrison's Have Made Films here a few years ago. And I actually met one of the guys that worked on it. You know, he was living on a traveller site in just outside London. And was saying how much fun it was to do. You know, very rarely are we making films like this. But I think it's the last Johnny English film with Rowan Atkinson. And in the film, this woman prime minister is constantly sidling up to this Zuckerberg tech giant character, knowing that it's him that can win her the election by the algorithms on his social media platforms. But it is a brilliant film, but it's actually Donald Trump. He has decided that these social media, and he's maybe right, that these social media people, a bit like maybe Thatcher or Blair and Rupert Murdoch back in the 1980s, '90s. So this is, I think, what's going on here, particularly with Musk. And of course, this is a deal with the devil because these people are after the government. They want to control the government. They want their technology to. They want to control the technology that controls the government, and they want this. I mean, they've done this in Britain now. We've got this thing called Humphrey, which is the AI system that Starmer has brought into the Cabinet Office. And Peter Kyle, who's the technology minister here in the UK, quite cheekily said to Matt Chorley at the BBC, who was interviewing him recently, he said, well, You can't see my face. You don't know if I'm an AI speaking to you or not, do you? And in a way, it should have been the journalist that brought that up, but it wasn't. It was the technology minister making a very important point that much of the politics now, the policy, as well as the speeches, I think, are actually being written by AI. That is quite feasible because what I've seen in my lifetime as a journalist in the last 40 years is I've seen a complete change. The radio station I worked on in London, Greater London Radio, anyone listening to that back in the 1990s would have known that the staff there, the presenters and the staff behind them were working for the listeners. We were rooting for our listeners. They knew it just by listening to the feel of the place, the way we were covering the news. We were trying to get them all the information they needed to lead a good Londoner life. And nowadays, you get none of that. You get none of the interrogative journalism. And what you're getting is bland. A lot of it is kowtowing to the press releases all the time. And so, what we've done is we've created a media, maybe this is totally deliberate actually, where you can swap it for AI and no one would even notice it, particularly with radio voices. So I think that's what they're actually up to, these people.
It's interesting what you just say because I've known a lot of journalists over the years, been doing this for a long time, and it was always there was always a motivator I could kind of identify of a search for the story, and where things fall, that's where they fall. We report it, and it is what it is. So what has happened in the culture of journalism, then, to basically switch that off? It's a mind-boggling question, really.
Well, it is. But look, at the BBC, I was there, I saw it. We had Zionist people coming in who were, I mean, they just happened to be Zionist, who were from advertising, from other sectors of the media, and being put in as senior producers. This is 1989,
Okay.
1990, not long after John Birt. But the thing is that the BBC was, when I first started there, still thought of as the sort of gold standard, of course the bad guys know that they've got to neuter the BBC in order to let the Murdochs become the, get up the viewing ratings, and so I think that's what's really been going on. But it's to do with the culture, a culture of fear being brought in. So in other words, people who are thinking about their job and keeping their job, much more than they are getting the story and being courageous about the story. The courageous journalists, I think, have been slowly, I shouldn't say weeded out because they're not the weeds, but they've been gotten rid of over the years. And particularly as well, they've been bringing in lots and lots of new, younger journalists who are very green, eager to impress. So, there are a few of us still left. We're having a pint in London actually tomorrow evening, and people who actually understand that you've got to be courageous and you've got to be prepared to stick your neck out a bit if you're going to get anywhere. But most of them, I'm afraid nowadays, to them it's just a sort of 9 to 5 job. It's a career, and they seem to, as journalists get more and more experience in dealing with powerful people, they get retired. This is I think that what's happened. But it's a shift towards a sort of shareholder owns the transmitter, and you as a journalist, where we can just drop you at the drop of a hat, you're off,
I want to go back to Trump because it's fascinating. So, a real estate developer in New York City in Manhattan is obviously going to encounter the mafia. There's no question. In construction, they're everywhere. And in utilities as well, that come after the thing is built. Now, obviously, you have to do deals to stay in business. That could be seen, and I'm not, being a fanboy for Trump, but I'm just sort of working through. That could be seen as quite a good experience in dealing with real tough people and sort of kind of working out motives. And then some of the crazy announcements. I never know whether it's 5D chess or just stupidity. But take, for example, what he said about Gaza. One thing that stood out for me in what he was saying and the sort of limited quotes I've seen, and maybe you heard him say this as well. He said, after you've finished your war, we'll take it over. And it sounded like a throwaway, but I thought about that. And really, he was putting Netanyahu in a very tough position because why would you end a war only to hand over the spoils to someone else? So it sounds sort of nutty, but there's a kind of sort of strategy to it as well, or am I sort of just trying to
Well,
imagine things that aren't there?
these two are working together. I mean, and also the fight, it's quite clear that just the land is not the actual final objective. I think that's true in Ukraine
It's
as
getting
well.
people off the land.
Well, I don't think even that is the final
Oh.
objective. Look, so the objective in Gaza ultimately is they want a war with Iran. They want to have a massive religious war there, and this is a part of that provocation. I don't think it's specifically about the Palestinians or specifically about the land. There's a bigger end plan. So, this thing that 1982, the Yinon plan, which was floated by Oded Yinon in Israel. Then we started to get lots of changes in the politics. So then we had the assassination of Rabin, Netanyahu coming in, the far right coming in. So there's this supposedly religious Zionist faction now in control who are absolutist. They're completely, well, you would call fundamentalist in control. But their aim seems to me absolutely to line up with this Albert Pike plan from the 1800s, which is to create a religious war with Islam. Now, think about what we had with the PLO in the old days, and Arafat was a secular, effectively secular organization. It wasn't just Muslims. Hamas, it has to be, to get a good religious war, you need to have just Muslims. That is Hamas. And of course, we know Netanyahu has been encouraging the funding of Hamas and saw it as a good thing in order to continue the fight and make it an even bigger fight. So I see that as it's almost like a kind of Armageddon plan, basically. And you're dealing with a nuclear armed doomsday cult. That's effectively what the Likud party and the far right bloc in Israel now are, because they actually see confrontation as good. The rest of the world is looking over there and saying, look, if you continue this confrontation, this could end up as a third world war. So, I mean, there's and the similar sort of thing in Ukraine, although I think it's much more, I think it's a safer war, really, in that I don't think it's going to, it's as capable as getting bigger
Well, because
as
it's not a sort of
quicker.
front, a face off between sort of religious, tectonic plates.
Well, maybe, yeah. But I mean, the Middle East has always been a big focus of attention. It's incredibly important strategically, being the pivot of Asia and Europe and Africa. I mean, the religions are one side, but Ukraine, I think what we're looking at there is just a way for the Brits. It seems to me the British. I mean, I've seen them training in Salisbury Plain here, the Ukrainian soldiers, and they don't stay long. Then they're out to fight, what we've got with this potential peace deal that's now coming along is a return to the Kissinger doctrine. Well, Henry Kissinger, when he was in power, in fact, he wrote his book about nuclear war after in the 1950s, I think, beginning of the 1950s, saying it was really, he didn't need to write a book. He could have just written one sentence, which was, don't pick fights with nuclear powers. Just fight anywhere you want in the world, do anything, absolutely anything, take over anywhere, bomb anywhere, but leave the nuclear powers alone.
Because it's all over, put it
Yeah,
that way.
well, yes, it's also, yeah, I mean, that was a very
For
simple,
everyone.
putting it very simply, but that's what he was saying. Now, so as he's kind of disappeared off the scene over the years, so other people have kind of come on the scene who are rather more maniacal. I mean, he did, before he died a couple of years ago, did say, look, if this thing with Ukraine, you're going to have to cede territory, blah blah blah, and then he popped off. But I think that's what's been happening this last week or so in Europe with Hegseth and the Rubio over in Europe, sending a
And
very clear
Vance, of
message to
course, and what he
Europe.
had to say, because you had grown German men, male politicians crying.
Well, I had to laugh because this is just stage. This is like, you may as well have Zelensky on the stage at the same time. This is not politics. This is theatre, and the fact is, if he wants to cry, he should cry over the Americans who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. I mean, that's something to cry about, maybe.
Where was
But
Article 5 when that happened?
well, nowhere. And so I think what's going on with Ukraine is that it's slowly everyone's kind of coming to realize that this has got to stop, and that Zelensky is actually just an actor, that the Ukrainians have got absolutely no say in anything that goes on. So why have them in the peace talks? This is a proxy war. It'd be interesting to see, though, what Putin will bargain for, because he may say, well, I want all the Russian-speaking oblasts, which might well include Odessa, in order to go away. And what's the point in me stopping, because we're taking more territory all the time? But I think the main purpose of the war has been obviously to boost the Nazis. So this has been very useful, to have a whole kind of Nazi contingent that no one questions, because they're fighting the Russians, and Putin will definitely want to have a deal which gets rid of them. Denazification was one of the main objectives when he first announced this special military operation invasion thing. Yeah, so that will be interesting, I think. But I think we can put it on the back burner. I think it's quite feasible anyway that back in November, these deals were already done quietly. Once it was clear Trump was in, he's sitting in Mar-a-Lago waiting to take over
Well, it
in
does
January.
have a feel of it being kind of set up, because these don't feel like random steps. They feel like they're sort of like sequential, well thought out, organized steps.
But the big question is, what's behind the maniacal Starmer, Sunak, the British hatred for Ukraine? What is it? And I mean, I can
Well,
only
for
try and
Ukraine or Russia, Tony?
sorry oh the sorry the hatred for Russia and
Yeah,
this
why is
ridiculous
that?
support for Ukraine. Well, we could spend an hour, right? But in a nutshell, I'll say it's two things. It's the Orthodox Church, which is a very old-fashioned form of Christianity in Europe, which is predates the Roman Catholics and Constantine, the Roman Emperor, converting or pretending to convert to Christianity, because he was finding the more Christians he killed, they were putting the dead Christians on top of poles, lampposts on the way into Rome, to light the way into Rome with burning Christians along the way. And it was failing, because more and more people were becoming Christians as a result. So their idea was, Constantine, look, we'll become Christians, and then we'll control their religion and whatever. So that was the Catholics. Then we had the Protestants in the mid 16th century, and the dissolution of the monasteries here, which was absolutely horrific. I mean, it was like a Holocaust, basically. All of your education system, all of your healthcare system is just like burnt to the ground.
That
They
was
weren't
under Henry
burnt.
VIII, right? That was
That's
Henry
Henry
VIII.
VIII. They weren't burnt,
Yeah.
but we've got all these like beautiful monasteries out all around the country, which were destroyed in the mid 1500s, and that was the Protestants. So, well, it was a Protestant king. And the idea was that we want a religion which the Catholicism is a bit too controlling. We want a religion which is safe for merchants and mercantile.
Safe and effective, Tony.
Well, that sort of thing. Yeah. So the thing is, you had a thriving trade merchant class that was doing very well. So anyway, that's the Orthodox Church versus the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church, which have both sort of gone away from all that. And it was interesting hearing Lavrov, I think it was yesterday, maybe even earlier today, talking about, what's happening with the rights for the Orthodox Christians in Ukraine. And this, anyway, so that's one thing. The other thing is the economy. They've got a completely different vision for the economy, that the Russians are into what they call industrial finance, right? And we are into finance capitalism. They have industrial capitalism, but the two are very, very different. So the infrastructure of the country is controlled by the government. So when you vote, you're voting for the water, the electricity, the trains, all this kind of stuff. Basic infrastructure is all controlled by the government and run by the government openly in public. So if you want to go along to your local, I don't know, water board, you can sit there and you can say, hang on, you didn't do this repair in our street. Privatizing all that is finance capitalism. And so you've got two completely separate, both in terms of religious faith across that border with Russia, between Russia and Ukraine and the rest of Europe, and the same with the system of government and finance. In Britain, we've now got a system where you can buy anything. You can buy a political party. You can buy what can you buy? You can buy a transmitter and a news empire. The Daily Telegraph was up for sale recently for next to nothing. This is what happens, and you can buy influence. So Those are the two completely different systems, and we hate the fact that Russia does the way things the way it does. Well, I don't, but our leaders do because it's such a good example. And they've made an absolute brilliant result from all the sanctions have been very good. The Russians have got all these massive industries now started up, which weren't there 5, 6 years ago when the sanctions, before the sanctions kicked in. They had to buy the stuff in. Now they've got, so they've had a boom economy. Ours is absolutely falling through the floor. The farmers, I don't know if you've been watching that.
Yeah, we've been
We've
watching.
had,
Yep.
yeah, we had, we've had 1,900 tractors and 3 tanks this week in last week in Whitehall. The farmers are, you don't, you mess with people, you mess with these people at your peril. You can end up with a famine if you mess around with the farmers. The farmers know it. They're not going to inflict a famine on us, but they could easily blockade motorways and blockade oil refineries if there are any left. But if you see what I mean, this is, they're really going completely nuts, basically. This is the effect of money poisoning policy and politics over here, and we hate it. The elite hate it when they can see if anyone actually can get through the firewall and see how well the Russians are doing, and also how much support their political leaders have in Russia itself. So yeah, it shames them, and they hate it.
Starmer's made comments within about 12 hours of us chatting here that there could be boots on the ground, UK boots on the ground as part of a peacekeeping role, and even that's being considered here. So, the tentacles do go far. And I don't know what the state of the US, sorry, the UK army or military as a whole is, but what I've heard is it's not very well equipped. Only a certain amount of gear is operational, and they don't really present much of a fighting force at all. How does that go down with the UK population? I mean, surely no one wants to see, unless you're kind of brainwashed into the Ukraine story, your sons, daughters, fathers, mothers on the firing line, the contact line in Ukraine.
Well, let's be clear, we've had British forces over there already, and they have been helping them use these Storm Shadow missiles. Not only that, we've had special forces over in Ukraine as well as in the Middle East. So, I mean, this is just where something that's been going on unofficially and illegally or whatever, people might say it's illegal, is slowly coming out to public view. But I'm not sure that these units will wish to deploy there. I mean, I remember contact it was there was one of these famous political announcements back, and it was around about 2003, I think, when Blair was in power. He made some announcement about the commandos down the road from us in Taunton, 40 commando going to Afghanistan. And there was a few rumors circulating that they weren't going to go. So they decided, no, we're not going to Afghanistan. You can't just order us around like that, which I thought was quite refreshing in a way. Anyway, so I remember getting in touch with them, speaking to somebody down there, who through coded language told me, no, we're not gone. We are not going. So they don't always do what they're told to do,
Right.
the armed forces, especially by, I mean, I think there's a, it might, in my contacts with them, they're very skeptical about these sorts of things, especially after the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, when intelligence and politicians tell. So there may be some pushback. I don't know. I can't say that for sure, but I don't know if they're ordered there. Would they definitely go? I'm not sure.
Last question. Is Vladimir Zelensky dead man walking now? He must
Well,
be, surely.
he looks to me like an actor whose props and stage are falling down around him. He's putting a bit of cocaine up his nose, and he's trying to make a brave face. He's being tough and strong, authoritative, convincing, all of the right things an actor's supposed to be. But behind him, it's all falling to bits. And it's probably better that he just gets off the stage as quick as before it actually falls right on his head. Maybe, I mean, everyone's been saying for years, haven't they, that he's probably going to just go to Florida. He's got a nice pad out there, so that's probably where he'll end up, and maybe not before too long. And that then a lot of the youngsters coming up to draft age in Ukraine can breathe a sigh of relief, and those hiding, in fact, can breathe a sigh of relief and come out again maybe when this peace deal gets done.
And what about the, some say up to 800,000, that's casualties, including deaths. They want some payback.
Who wants the payback?
The families, the mothers, the fathers of people who were pulled off the street and put into the army and killed a few days later in huge numbers. I
Well,
mean,
it's a deeply traumatized country, isn't it? Just like, say, somewhere like Nazi Germany or Holland under Nazi occupation was. How are they going to put that back together again? I mean, certainly if I'd been living there and seen this kind of stuff coming along, I hope I would have made it across the river in the summer, out of there, because it was an absolute killing zone, Ukraine. Used, totally used and abused by NATO, and particularly by Britain, to be a little stick to poke Putin with, which is infantile. Really, and yet hundreds of thousands of people, mostly young men, have been needlessly killed. I don't know if you've been watching the videos of the British mercenaries that have been captured by the Russians. I mean, it's heartbreaking to see these lads, young people in Britain, most of them either been in the army for a while, been cashiered out of the army for whatever reason, and ended up on the dole, sleeping on the streets or whatever, and they've said, well, the only thing I can do is fight. I've been learned. I know how to use this anti-tank gun or something, and so I've got to become a mercenary. And then they find they're over there in Ukraine, being used and abused by the Ukrainian army, and finding that they're witness to all sorts of horrific war crimes and things like that. I mean, they've been tending to be quite happy to be captured by Russians, making sure that if they know they haven't got a weapon, they'll sit down with the Russians and say, "Thank God you're here," just like some of the people have been doing in the Donbass, in the southeast of Ukraine. Thank God the Russians are finally here, and you sit down and have a cigarette with them, because they're far more civilized than these Nazis. And they're not all Nazis, but that if you've got your secret police being pro-Nazi, and you're absolutely up for bullying tactics, killing people, all sorts of dirty tricks, and your ideology is just, in this fascist kind of fashion, is just maniacal. I mean, the essential thing about the Nazis is they worship their sort of ancestor people like Bandera, and they also are absolutely allied with the oligarchs, the oligarchy. I mean, this is what Putin dealt with in Russia. The oligarchs were dealt with, and they were kept out of the Kremlin, and that was in the 2000s. And that was so it's such an important thing to do. He let them stay. They could do their mafia stuff and whatever, but if you come near the Kremlin, you're going to get your legs chopped off, your fingers chopped off, whatever. Keep away. And they did. And ones that didn't were deported or imprisoned. And that needs to happen in every country on planet Earth. And it seems to me that it's the total opposite in Ukraine. And the idea is this is a model for other countries, around in Eastern Europe, for the West to manipulate them into this position where they're totally run by organized crime and Nazis. So obviously the Russians are going to want to make sure that the Russian speakers in Ukraine are kept safe, number one. And that there's no ability for them to attack Russia. And number two, that they have full denazification, so that this is gone. And Starmer putting his oar in by saying we're going to send a load of troops in there. Well, let's see if they go.
All right, on that note, Tony, Tony Gosling, independent journalist, beaming in from the UK. Thanks for joining us again, Tony. We'll keep a close eye on things, and I'm sure we'll be back with you pretty soon because everything's moving so
Can I
quickly.
just
And
plug my show?
please do.
I do a weekly program, which is about three. Last week was 4 hours, and we do. I mean, we did a whole deep look at social services, looking at several incidents of horrific activities by state social services, or not acting in the children's best interest at all, number one. Number two, gaslighting people who are trying to do the right thing. And number three, trying to take people's kids off them. And this sort of thing where they're perfectly good parents. So I don't know if they're trying to tick boxes or, they've got a certain amount of kids that they've got to process every month, and if they don't, they lose their bonus. I've no idea how bad it is. But also we had a good look at this guy Todd Ryder over in the States, who's done an amazing series with this Hidden History program. He's been spending like a decade going through the US archives looking at the Nazi bomb. So the atomic bomb, and I didn't realize that the Nazis had actually designed a nuclear weapon in 1934. But his presentations on the Nazi nuclear weapons, and of course, this throws a completely new light on the end game of World War II with Operation Paperclip and all those Nazis going to the States. So, I mean, what we're saying here is, look, what he's implying in all this, he doesn't say this, I say it, is that if they had a bomb in 1944, they must have realized, look, we can't use this and win the war. So we may as well just use it as a bargaining chip at the end of the war to get what we want at the end, and then give that technology as they did to the United States in May 1945. This bit of history needs to be rewritten. Todd's made it really clear. So that's the sort of thing I do. The website is thisweek.org.uk, and it's UK time, 5 o'clock till 8 o'clock every Friday live.
Wow, you've got me interested in that one. I think heavy water was the German research method
Well,
to
look,
create their bombs.
it's great that you've said that, because he talks about this in his presentation. I'll send you a popular link on the chat
Please
or
do.
whatever
Yeah,
afterwards,
I'm
because
really interested.
he talks about heavy water, and he says, oh, there's just all this fuss about the heroes of Telemark and the Norsk Hydro plant. But then he shows you some German, sorry, the American documents that showed the German sites where they were making heavy water. There's at least 10 of them. And so the film is saying, oh, thank God they can't make the bomb. Well, the Nazis weren't stupid. They're not going to just use one site. They had loads of sites. So if one or two of them got bombed, that they could carry on making the bombs. And
Well,
so
actually, you've just reminded me, because didn't Hitler always have faith in a super weapon? And people have been talking about the V1 or the V2 rocket, the ME-262, as being kind of super weapons. But that's probably what he had in mind.
I think you're absolutely right, and I know I read I can't remember the guy's name. It's a book called Most Secret War, and he was the chief scientific advisor to the War Cabinet. And in the 1980s, most of the stuff had been declassified. He wrote a fantastic. It was a bestseller in the 80s, and in there, he's constantly saying, "Well, Churchill was telling us that there might be a V2 with a nuke on it hit London any time." So Churchill knew. And this, of course, is well, the Nazis were right, weren't they? We need to use this to bargain. You know what I mean? They were in 1944, towards the end, they were definitely doing that. But heavy water is deuterium, and the Nazis had designed, I don't think they ever tested it, but they'd also designed a thing called a lithium deuterium bomb, which was a different type to the plutonium one, which was used in Nagasaki, and the uranium one, which was used in Hiroshima.
Yeah,
So they
they're
had a
two different.
different type that they'd already
Yeah.
designed. So
They
that's
were
one of the reasons
testing
they
the
wanted
models
loads of heavy
out.
water.
Yeah. They were testing out the models. They were.
I mean, the scientists had designed these things. They were building up all the stockpiles of the materials to make them, and they definitely tested probably two, definitely one. But anyway, Todd Ryder is your man, and I'd only
Yep.
come across him last week, but I was so impressed. I sat and watched through his thing. I mean, he's got all the documents there. So that's what I do every week, and I try and do a bit of everything, actually, Paul. I mean, I'm not if whatever lands on my desk, if it looks good, I'll put it out there.
Okay, Tony Gosling, thanks for being with us again. We'll talk soon.
We will. Thanks very much. Cheers.